Greetings, everybody. This is Eric Andelin, Senior Workflow Specialist with SimActive, and you're joining us for episode number 25 of the Pixels and Points podcast, Obliques for Mapping, Are They Really Useful? And with me today, I have my guest, David Alamillo, Photogrammetry Specialist with SimActive. David, say hi.
Hey, hi, guys. Glad to be here. It's been a while. You had some great guests over the past few webinars, so again, pretty honored to be here with you guys today.
Absolutely. It's going to be fun. Before we start, a quick bit of house cleaning for our listeners. This podcast comes from a webinar that was recorded earlier. That webinar has a video component to it. If you'd like to follow along, you can find that on our website under the Learning tab. We'll continue. The topics that we're going to cover are the difference between nadir and oblique imagery, mapping versus modeling, considerations for successful oblique imagery acquisition, and then processing options in correlated 3D. David, introduce yourself to everybody. Let them know what your role is here at SimActive, and then we'll start from there.
Sure. Thank you, Eric. David Alamillo, of course, probably had the honor to work with a lot of you folks on the support side. I'm the photogrammetry specialist here at SimActive. I've been with the company for 2 years, a little bit more than that. And like I said, been working mainly on support and success. We kind of try to divide it in both, but once you're on Correlator, we want to make your experience as smooth as possible, give you the best tips and tricks, you know, for especially for tricky data. So I was very excited about this particular topic because it's been really relevant in the industry nowadays. And there are little tips and tricks here and there that they make a huge difference. So again, happy to be here and happy to be here with you, Eric.
Yeah, absolutely. So I actually have some props with me too, so I'll keep those nearby. But but again, my background is aerial photography and mapping. I help with the workflows here at SimActive, and I go way back. And David and I talked about this a little bit prior to the webinar. I grew up in Southern California. Our aerial photography company was based out of Orange County, so our approach was Disneyland. And that's where I learned to capture my first stereo models. But it's also... You know, I got hung out to dry many times doing obliques in a 172, you know, with a full frame camera, and there are no gimbals. So the only way you can do that is to tilt the plane to capture the photos, you know, which is a challenge. So it left me a little queasy on occasion, but, you know, I survived and I'm still here to, you know, to enjoy what we're doing. So, but we could talk right off about the difference between nadir and oblique imagery, and I'll bring up my prop right here, my camera. There, my camera.
Oh, nice.
Nadir. That's nadir.
What model is that, Eric?
It's a Sony IXR2 or something like that. Yeah.
Are they sponsoring us?
They are not.
They should.
They should. So, again, this is nadir, nice. Straight down. Oblique is any angle in any way that you turn this camera. So I just want to clarify that right off the bat because people sometimes don't know what nadir is. Oblique can be anything all the way, you know, up to this. For mapping purposes, it's down here. I put away my prop for now and we can continue from there. So David, other comments on the difference between oblique and nadir imagery?
I had my own prop today.
Do you?
I have my DeLorean, my flying DeLorean. So yeah, exactly the same concept. I left this guy today because it's I see sometimes there's a little misconception with nadir mapping versus slight oblique. Mm-hmm. And then there's, of course, the oblique that it's pointing completely at the horizon. So literally we're flying vertically and taking pictures of the sun and the mountains. And I think that's one of the pure misconceptions in the industry sometimes, where basically have your slight obliques as the manufacturer recommends. And then there are automated missions that can go very, very extreme oblique. And they're basically pointing to the sun. And when you review the pictures that you're processing, you see like 2010 pictures pointing straight at the sun and the mountains, even your buddy out there partying while you're doing the collection and they're right in the frames. And obviously these images are no good for the purpose of the mapping mission, but it's very common to collect, you know, and it's sometimes a little misconception. So yeah, I love your prop, nadir, slight oblique, and then completely pointing at the horizon, right? So
yeah,
that's a very good way to start this topic.
Yeah, and again, we're talking about or mapping. So, I mean, there are other tools out there that if you wanted to point it straight, you know, towards the sun and the horizon and all that, they use what's called depth mapping to eliminate that area, which is basically infinity, so that you could actually map. And you'll see that a lot, like when they do it with an iPhone or something like that, they build, you know, points and things like that. You know, hey, it's a model. It's called a model for a reason, because it's a model. And that's what you would use that for. But for our intents and purposes, we're just talking about for mapping in Nader. And again, going back to my experience as a kid with a full frame, full format aerial mapping camera, you know, those things were hard mounted into the bottom of an aircraft. So you didn't have the benefit of a gimbal. So, I mean, you had your pitch, roll, and yaw, and you had a little bit of obliqueness to imagery, you know, on occasion, just correct, because of, you know, the turbulence and things like that, but you had to work around that. But then to specifically go to in mapping, where we started to look at maybe obliques can play a role, is, yep, you know, farther along when we came out with more small format sensors or multi-imaging sensors, mm-hmm, and then multi-rotors with gimbals on them. And then now, yes, you know, now we graduate up to, you know, again, multiple sensors in drones, in fixed wing drones, correct, where their oblique angle is fixed. So, you know, give me some thoughts on that.
Yes, it's very interesting, right? My experience, of course, is not as ample as yours. I started off with fixed wing drones, and the fixed wing drone that we were flying, the first experience I had was flying a golf course, mapping purposes, right? It was irrigation, and it was a renovation of a golf course. So the product was mapping, but the superintendent heard about 3D models that you could produce out of UAVs. So he said, hey, how come you haven't given me a 3D model of the golf course? I said, well, again, back to the initial thought, it's mapping purposes. I remember going back home and reading on the manual and see if this drone could actually pitch to get, you know, even a slight oblique and reconstruct like there were basically the houses and in along the golf course and then the shops and everything. So it was quite challenging to get something out of that specific fixed wing drone in order to get a 3D model. And, you know, I produced a 3D model out of it, but of course it had a ton of holes. And once we rotated and trees were empty, this is not the right flight mission for this product. So I was completely honest with the superintendent, told him, look, it looks terrible. It looks like a cake gone bad. And I understood the concept of not having, you know, oblique imagery to do that type of work. So in that moment, it was easy to explain to superintendent, look, the map looks amazing. It's an amazing product. You guys have been able to do all your irrigation work and layout. But when it comes to 3D modeling, it is not the right approach on how I am collecting the data. Yeah. Or in that time, it was even the restrictions on the drone, how to make it tilt in order to get a slight oblique angle of those images, right? So
yeah,
good. Again, those were the challenges.
Yeah, for a lot of people, I mean, know that in the fixed wing drones, they're like aircraft. They're typically hard mounted, and you know, to point to Nader.
Yes.
If you wanted back in the day, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, if you wanted oblique, you could kind of tilt the camera within, you know, its holder, and maybe yes, get something out of it. But, you know, yep, that would require two missions and, you know, all that. To what benefit is the question? Because, you know, when we started mapping, it was just 2D mapping of the ground, contours, all of that stuff. Then, you know, yep, mapping evolved a little bit to deal with structures and large buildings and things like that, and trying to capture the orthomosaics. And, mm-hmm, you know, you've got building lean you have to deal with, and you got to work around that. But then yes, the next iteration was, well, yeah, we have building lean, but can we see what's on the building? Can we see the side of the building? How do we see the side of the building? And then, yeah, you know, we get into, okay, now maybe oblique imagery has some value in this proposition, and how do we add it in? So
yeah,
mapping evolves and map products evolve, and you can see some value in that. So that's a big reason that we're looking into this now, or, you know, yeah, the users are looking at it. So, but how about, you know, if you want, explain a little bit, you know, what the difference is between mapping and modeling.
Sure. You know, as I mentioned and opened up earlier, you know, with mapping, the product was super fast to process. Number one, I was only using Nader images only. So the exactly what we had to deliver, we were delivering in this case, which was basically a terrain for irrigation purposes, brand new sprinkler system. There were two golf courses were adjacent to each other, so they were basically a pretty big lot that we needed to map. Thinking about it now, if I had to provide a 3D model for the superintendent, would he want the entire area? Not really. You know, it wasn't of any purpose to have the two golf courses mapped for 3D modeling purposes. He only wanted the shops, you know, he only wanted to where the shops were to see what conditions the roof were and whatnot. So that's where I understood it. And I was like, okay, well, in this case, I grabbed the little Mavic 3D DJI drone that I had, and I did a manual mission of that, which I intended to capture oblique imagery out of, you know, out of that mission. Now, the main difference was that I wasn't flying the entire area. It wasn't two golf courses. It was one specific area. It was one specific unit. So something that I've noticed in 3D modeling is there's definitely smaller areas that you need to map to reconstruct, that you can create amazing 3D models and very nice 3D models, but it's a very targeted approach versus when you map an entire city, right? You wouldn't use the same flight mission, flight plan to do an entire city with that. It would take just ages to do. So that was something that I immediately recognized something that was completely different from mapping just terrain and the mapping in general versus 3D modeling, where it involved spending more time really planning my mission. And I remember even for this was 8, 9 years ago, I had to hand fly that mission because there was no automatic flight planner that would create, you know, basically the orbit around the object or the angles I needed to use. So I hand flew the mission to get what I would call a decent 3D model nowadays. Wasn't even the best that we could produce now, but that was the main difference. I think if you're truly mapping, you know, the obliques, and depending on the terrain, of course, in the application, might nadir might be totally fine and enough for what you're doing. If you're flying a cityscape or you're planning to fly downtown LA to get facade of buildings, slight oblique would work perfectly for that purpose. And if you go in to do one home, this goes back to another application, which is real estate. Realtors nowadays take out their drones, fly the property to get a nice 3D model of the property to put on their listings. That is a completely different approach, right? They'll take time to set the right angle, make sure they don't disturb the neighbors because they definitely need to fly lower in order to capture those details. So that has been the main differences I've seen from mapping versus 3D modeling. Again, it's a very specific output that you analyze. Real life models, that's what most people want to get out of it, you know, mainly for inspections of buildings and whatnot, you know, but this is what the main differences I've seen in both worlds.
Yeah, I would just add to that. I mean, it's really easy to create a flight plan for mapping, and it's relatively easy for the AT process and all of those things. And what you get out of it is something that, if you used control, you can make accurate measurements from. 3D models, that's a little bit different. When you're specializing in one area or one structure or something like that, from aerial photography, you're probably not going to get enough of it to create a 3D model that you could measure to some accuracy. But if you were on the ground, maybe you're using mobile LiDAR, maybe you're using terrestrial LiDAR, you're capturing RGB imagery, you're capturing it from every angle, you're setting up from above, below, all of those things. Then yes, absolutely, you can make a model that you could make measurements from and would be pretty darn accurate. But to scale that to the size of a mapping project, now we're talking about square miles or square kilometers or things like that. Man, it just became really, really difficult. And quite honestly, the cost to create such a model would be unsustainable for somebody who's looking at it. Now, that's not to say that there aren't companies out there doing city modeling. That's certainly out there, and I've seen some really great stuff. Is it something you can make measurements from and trust is a complete accurate solution? I don't know. And when you start talking about freshness date of imagery, if you think, you know, a major city has flyover every quarter, you
Correct.
know, it you can turn that around pretty fast. It'll be fresh, it'll be available. But if you're talking about doing city modeling and then to do that on a continuous basis for the byproducts that somebody would use it for, I don't know. I don't see it. Not now, not today.
Yeah,
You know.
agree 100% on that thought. Yeah, absolutely.
And you're getting gaming
Absolutely.
engines involved and all kinds of things like that, you know, because again, to make a stunning full-size 3D city model, you're going to need some, you know, some major power behind you and some major man hours to get a product out that looks really good and then look good.
Will look good. Yeah, exactly. I also manipulating those large files becomes, you know, quite a challenge as well. You know, you're exporting huge files, millions of triangles, and creating a mesh. And you know, it's basically that topic is, can you render that? Oh, what PC do you need to render something that big? And of course, not that, but doing measurements and editing, you know, it's a very, very powerful thing. I mentioned the real estate approach where it's just, they're just beauty shots, right? The realtor really doesn't care about the accuracy. He cares about how looking good. So in that term, I was saying, you know, well, of course, yeah, it's more beautification of the building, getting the best sides ever, but not interested in accuracy at all.
Yeah,
That's something that
ironically,
never
the
really.
house I'm sitting in, we never saw it when we bought it. It was brand new, and we were on our way to a conference when we saw the house listed. The only thing we saw was the Matterport 3D rendering.
Oh,
And
now you
somebody
get into
had come by in the facility, in the building, and use that to create the 3D model. Outstanding. I mean, without that, we wouldn't have known that we wanted this house. You know, but again, that's from the
That's
inside, not the outside. Maybe if they'd have flown it from the outside, we would have seen what was going on with our neighbors, and we might have said, oh, we don't want to live here. Who knows? Who knows?
you're out in the backyard like, nope, I don't want to be that guy's neighbor.
So
I
yeah,
hear you.
taking it to extremes, but it's two different things. You know, and again, mapping is you're doing volume comps, you're doing planimetrics,
Correct.
you're capturing features that you can measure from one side to the other, and this and that. You know, and that's a proven product. Modeling, there's probably so much more you could do with it if we get to the point where viable. And it's not to say again that you can't do it now. It's just to at scale, at accuracy, at all those things. You know, we're probably getting into the world of LiDAR and terrestrial LiDAR and things like that. You know, again, not aerial necessarily. So
That's right.
yeah. So, and then, you know, again, some of the reasons for this. So let's talk about what you have to think about when you're collecting data for Oblique and to create deliverables. You know, tell us a little bit about the differences.
Certainly. You mentioned something that I laughed because that's indeed what I thought when I saw the flight plans that were necessary, right, for collecting mapping purposes in general. It was just the straight flight lines, right? Parallel flight lines, really fast, and the drone comes, and I still have battery left for another mission. Where it leaks, I had to take, like I said, the first mission, I hand flew that, which in essence, it was pretty challenging because I wasn't very used to, first of all, the joystick, and am I going to crash into this thing? I'm flying at much lower altitudes, so there are power lines, trees that I can definitely go into. So it required much more planning than my mapping mission for sure. That's number one. Nowadays, we can go take the DeLorean back into the future, and now we have automated missions that do oblique mapping, and it's you know they're very popular brands out there. SET, oh, Smart Oblique, let's go with this. And you know we're in that generation. We don't want to really read on things. We just want to press a button and let it rip and get the best results ever, me included. So when you go into these missions with no type of planning and you just press a button and expect the best output, that's when you start seeing issues. Because smart as the drones can be today, there is planning that goes behind it, right? Exactly what are you going to fly? If we're going to fly Disneyland, of course, the permissions we need to fly Disneyland, but what angle we want to capture, what's the right angle for the sensor to begin with, if it's a 45-degree angle, if we're going to go a little bit more extreme, less extreme. And then it goes into concentrating on the geometry, I think of the structure you want to map. That's very important. Take in consideration what you're going to map in the geometry, what you want to map, and then that will certainly help reduce all the anomalies that we talked about. You know, very, very bad product at the end because you didn't take that in consideration. Again, if you're mapping just the house for realtor purposes, you know, you basically have to take in consideration the houses that are around it when you're going to do that pass. And if the drone has an automated mission, it's important for us to look at the mission and see, is this mission even viable to launch, you know, before we lose the drone. So things that I've checked is obviously light condition, checking the geometry of the structure you want to map. If I will need nadir pictures with that or only obliques, that's something important that goes into play because I can only capture obliques and I'm so focused on the obliques and facades and getting the best detail on the windows that I want to map on, let's say a house again for a structure or a building, that I forget that I might need nadir pictures as well. So sometimes we completely disable the nadir portion of it when they add a lot of value. I think going into details, you know, just having a decent overlap, you know, between the shots that you collect on the oblique side versus the nadir make a great solution. So it is not only oblique, you can't take the nadir out of the equation. You have to have a nice overlap set of images between both. And I don't know if you've seen that, in your experience as well.
Yeah. And again, we're talking about, again, if you're talking about a structure, one structure, then if you've got a multi-rotor with a gimbal, then you can just design, a corkscrew pattern around it or something like that where you're capturing every angle. That's easy to do. But it becomes different when you're using a fixed wing because typically those are, either a nadir camera and a forward camera that's a little bit oblique, or it's a
Yeah.
nadir camera and then four cameras that are oblique pointing out in, north, south, east, west, basically,
Correct.
away from nadir. And then you've got to redesign your lawnmower patterns of flight to account for that nadir angle capturing the sides of structures within a whole entire area. So you're at least doubling, if not quadrupling, flight patterns to capture those
Yep.
areas. And I know, we'll talk about that a little bit here coming up. So the last thing, let's talk a little bit about processing options in Correlated 3D. And you're welcome to jump right in and show people what we're talking about, but let's kind of go over that, the steps that you would need to go through, everything we would do in Correlated 3D.
Yeah, absolutely. And we talked about not having nadir pictures. And there, one point that I'll just add to that is the extent, right? Sometimes when you're creating your mission for nadir, you don't really have to worry about the extent of how much you need to cover, on the sides, east, south, northwest. But obviously, if you want to capture the oblique side of that last building and your last flight line, you have to extend it a little bit more in order to capture that building as well. So something that I see with capturing these missions, especially on fixed wings. And there's some great fixed wing drones out there. Same great sensors that are oblique sensors, dedicated sensors to do this type of work, where I think it's very simple to do. But at the same time, here's where you come with the mission planning and saying, okay, how far do I need to go? Did I undershoot that? Oh man, I missed the last, row of buildings and that structure. How did I miss them? It's just you missed a calculation that this was supposed to be an oblique mission, so you missed those on the side. So anyway, just a little planning on there, guys who are listening to us. Always spend time planning the mission. Don't go out into the field and say, I'll figure it out there. Yeah, and then most likely you'll forget it. So you need to create your missions beforehand when you go out there. I know everyone mostly does, so I'm probably speaking for myself.
Yeah, absolutely, because we don't go out as much. But to add to that, I mean, in a mapping mission, you always go beyond your project boundaries to some degree because you
Correct.
just don't want to go back out again. But when now you're talking
Yes.
about obliques, so you really need to go outside your project boundaries because the
Yes.
oblique angle that you're capturing it at off one side may not even appear in the project boundaries after you've flown it. So you really have to go big.
That's right. Go
So
big or go
yes.
home.
So let's go and look at how you would set something up in Correlated 3D, in some
Sure.
examples. Okay.
Let's do it. So I think the example we have is exactly that, what you mentioned. It's we'll do one nadir and then we'll do four obliques.
Okay.
And this, I believe it's the D2M, if I'm correct, from
Correct.
Quantum, right? And so
Yep.
let's take a look at that project. So with everyone familiar with Correlator, and who's not familiar with Correlator, once you install the software, this is the welcome screen. Once you're in it, we're basically going to go through the process of importing our data. That's really the first step. So you can see I'm rocking dark mode. I love dark mode. I can't go back to light mode. But for any of those who don't like dark mode, you can certainly change it here from the file section, general settings, and make that adjustment. But if you're team dark mode, stay with me in dark mode. Rocks at night, especially doing projects late. So what we're gonna do here, you see the list of modules at the top. We're gonna obviously begin on our first module, which is create a new project, and we're gonna go through the process of adding our imagery. So in this case, UAV, we're going to default to this license. And here comes the first step, Eric. We mentioned D2M, Quantum. We have basically five cameras. So we have the nadir plus four obliques. So we're going to increase the number of cameras, and we're going to do this by simply adding and going up to five. Something cool that we can do in this setup is we can rename the cameras as well. Just ease of use for us to know exactly what camera we're importing and what time. So I suggest you guys rename them. Maybe going back to one point is the prep to do the import is, as you can see, you need to have those images separated. So you have your nadir images in one folder, your rear images in one another folder, forward images in one folder, left and right. That's exactly what I did for this data set, and then we'll basically continue with that. So that's kind of one of on the prep side, something that you would need to do. The other change I'm going to make here is the number of groups. I'm going to use only one group. This is only these, even though these sensors are separate cameras, but they're part of one single sensor. So we're going to treat it as that. So we're only adding one group. If you bear with me, we can go and rename these. We'll go for nadir on the first one, and let's do rear on this guy. We'll do forward on the other one, and we'll continue. And finally, right. Perfect. As simple as that. Once we have our camera IDs renamed, we'll hit next and we'll add our images. So as I mentioned before, let's go to the folder structure. Let's add folders. And here I'm already defaulted to nadir. So just so you guys can see, I have left, nadir, rear, right, forward. So I have them all separated in different folders. We're going to start nadir. And there we go. The software will read the EXIF of the data. So you can see it's coming in, image name, long lat, altitude. Something to point about this specific sensor is I don't have attitudes, Eric. So again, something that we'll have to treat using the camera mount rotation due to the lack of attitudes. So for you folks who are flying these type of sensors and have oblique, but don't have any attitudes, you don't have any omega p kappa, you can add the camera mount rotation. For this D2M sensor, these are going to be the values. So for nadir, we're going to use +180. And make sure you change this for every sensor. I'm going to give you the formula as we go. But in this case, this is specifically because we don't have any attitudes for this sensor. Mm-hmm. So we're going to hit add, confirm our projection for that set of images, hit OK, 323 images. We'll hit next, very important. And then you can see the sensor we're processing, right? RP2625 from Rainpoo, nadir. We confirm our focal length, 25, our pixel size is 376, 3.76 microns. Hit next. And then you can see here, it's important. It's asking us for the back, rear. What we have to import is the images that correspond to the naming convention that we added.
Right.
So we're going to go again to look for the folder and select and import. Now for this specific one, we're going to go +180. So once we confirm that, we're going to go add again. Confirm our common systems, hit next. This focal length you can see is different, guys. So it's very important to check always your focal length and pixel size. So 35, 3.76, that is correct. And move on to forward. So we will repeat this process for every single oblique. Again, we simply go back a folder, go forward on this case, select. In this case, we're gonna go with a camera mount rotation of 0. And we're gonna add, okay. Next, left. We're going to do all here. And we're going to go with left, select the images. We're going to go with +90. I'll make sure to add this to the community forum. So you guys have questions about this specific webinar, you guys can read about the camera mount rotations that I'm using.
Perfect.
In this case, left is +90. Yeah, we'll go okay. Next. And we come out to our final one, which is right. Let's look for that right folder, select. And add, click mount rotation will be set to -90. So again, for those folks that are keeping up, nadir was +180, the rear was +180, forward was 0, left +90, right -90. That's basically how it went. And again, I'll put this in our community forum for you guys to read up on it. We have some other great topics there that you definitely should check out. So let's finish that by just creating a final folder here. We'll call Super Workshop and we'll let these images load. And that's how it should look. So there are little process in there. If we zoom in, you guys will be able to right click any of the images. Let's go to the project tree because that's something important. Here's where you can see them broken down. Very important. I guess this is a very important part of the process. And we'll talk a little bit more about when we orthorectify. But here you have your separate groups of images. And of course, if we wanted to see a flight line specifically, we can, just basically go to that image. Yep. And then we get a little preview of it. Of course, if you wanted to see some specific groups, you can disable them. The view, at least from here, you can see it's actually disabling it from the view, not the image, but disabling the view. So if you wanted to see this rear picture, here we go. Just just right click it. Was that clear enough, Eric? Did that make sense?
I'll just bring up also that you have a visual heads up in Correlator 3D. So once you load these, if you don't see that cross pattern that we're seeing here, then you could tell that you've got one of your images is, or one of your groups of images is not pointed in the correct direction. So, just again, as soon as you pull it up, you see that, you can say, okay, everything's in the right place.
That's right. It's a great indicator, right? So yeah, you can definitely check that out. So the next step in the process, it's very similar to what you guys would be doing regularly with your imagery, right? We have them all separated in one group, and then we can go through our aerial triangulation. So let's go there. Turn on, the software will automatically prompt you to do the tie point extractions. If I hit yes, again, this is really depending on the terrain type, standard or exhaustive. Yep. We'll do standard hit process. And there we go. That's the first step in our AT. Now, of course, for timing purposes, we'll go to a project which obviously is completed. So let's open up that project really quick. And we can review the AT there.
Yeah.
There we go. Nice and completed. So let's go back to our AT. We'll let this refresh background imagery. There we go. We're going to go to the steps. The bundle adjustments. So now that our tie points are completed, let's look at our tie points here real quick. And we have our tie points complete. Of course, these are relating to the different image groups that we might have, right? So there's tie points created for every single group of images that we imported. So for our nadir, for our rear, for our front, for forward, yeah, we have basically tie points created for each and one of those. So some folks might say, hey, on this particular sensor, it took a little longer to do my tie point extraction than it typically does for just my regular mapping mission. It is true. It is because we are creating more tie points based on the different sensors that are being imported. So if you see a small increase on time on that, completely normal, especially for those folks who are used to processing data super fast with Correlator. But now that we see our tie points, they look really well. And we can move on to the next step, bundle adjustment.
Yep.
We'll go to bundle, click bundle adjustment, and we're going to go for a full AT unconstrained, Eric. So we'll do unconstrained EU adjustment, unconstrained sensor calibration, and process. This is what we want to do for this data set. And of course, you guys see the results here in the background. Everything is nice and green as it should look. We can obviously look at the report really quick to see what's going on behind the scenes. Again, 323 images or five groups, excellent image tie points. And then the assessment, we go with the bundle adjustments, right? Unconstrained bundle adjustment. And then we can see the before and after our bundle. Mm-hmm. So, there's an adjustment for every camera. Of course, you can see that adjustment in your report. And of course, you can go down into the sensor calibration, for each one of those sensors. So here's where I'll open it up for you. Of course, you're the master of accuracy, Mr. Eric. So any comments regarding this?
Yeah, I would say my comments to that is that when you go oblique, you kind of give up some of that accuracy. It is what it is because you're now using a different part of the image in your project. So I would rely more on the nadir for the accuracy. And then rely more on the obliques, for capturing whatever texture you're trying to capture. But you're not going to see metric cameras doing this in drones. You may in large format aircraft, and you have to be able to allow leeway in your AT process to correct for that. So unconstrained is always going to provide you a better solution. That's all I have to say about that.
Yeah. I completely agree. Now, it is a simple process, guys. The most important thing here is how you import your data. And of course, in this case, for the D2M is different values. You have the mount rotations. Something I want to close with this is, will my project always look as green as David's? No, not necessarily, guys. When dealing with oblique data, sometimes you'll see some yellow images out there. You'll see some higher, medium residuals out there. Don't be scared of your project, or don't be alarmed if your project doesn't look as good as the one we're showing out here. There might be some projects that are more challenging than others, and they might have some images that have a higher residual. You shouldn't be worried about that. Of course, the excellent tie point assessment that we saw, let's look at that again. Quality assessment is excellent. The average projection error is 0.55 pixels, standard deviation 0.27. So we can focus on that. And one of our colleagues, Thomas, always tells me, David, focus on the results. How do the results look? And so it's my motto now, of course, and I try to share it with the customers, is focus on the results. Yeah. How do the results look? How does the DSM, DTM look? How does the mosaic look? But it's important to note that sometimes with these type of oblique sensors, Everything's not going to look as green as it does right now on the screen. So the next product we're going to move on now that we completed our AT, successful AT, is the DSM. And, you know, talking about the DSM, let's go back to the image groups. We have two options now. Do we want to create a DEM that uses all five sensors, or do we want to use just an eight-year sensor? That's a very good question, I think, right, Eric?
That's a, yeah, absolutely. And kind of leads back to what I said. You know, if you want the most accurate, I'd use an eight-year.
Yeah, agree 100%. And the other thing is the extent of the DM using only an eight-year, right? It's definitely a smaller area.
Yes.
Sometimes they focus on AOI, so it's more than enough. But when you enable all groups and all sensors, the DM will definitely use all those oblique sensors and create a much larger extent of the DM. So that's important to know too. Some folks might say, hey, but you know, that DM looks really small and I only process the nadir images. Exactly, because you're only using nadir. So when you use all five sensors, and definitely you'll get a larger extent, but I want to show folks, how do you do that? How do you just enable the nadir and disable the others? Really simple. You'll go to the project tree, and you can see here I have my group one nadir, and then I can simply disable that. Of course, I don't want to do that because I want to leave that for my DM. So I'm going to disable the forward, open group three, disable left, disable the rear, and disable the right. So I have now officially disabled all the sensors, and I can go safely into the DSM generation. And at this point, the DSM and the software will only take into account that group of images that we left there enabled. So that's really the trick, guys, if you want to do that. Now, if you're at home doing a comparison, guys, you want to say, hey, I want to see how really large the extent is using all five, be my guest, you can leave them enabled. And do the DSM and compare. But I recommend going with the nadir and using that one for your DM. I don't know if anything else you would add to this.
Well, I would just say some of the logic in that is that a nadir image, when the software goes to calculate out what the average pixel size is in a nadir image, it's working with a almost flat surface. So yes, the camera does have some, it does spread out as you go farther away from the center of the camera, and we only use so much of it from center. But if you think about it, average pixel size across that image, nadir image, is about the same. But when you turn something oblique, now farther away you get from center, on the high side, those pixels start to get stretched really long and big, which affects your overall output resolution. So that's one reason to go with nadir.
Very well. Yeah, 100% agreed. Yeah. That also applies to the next part of the process, which is orthorectifying. And for this specific process, we do only want to keep the nadir images. That's like a must. So I really encourage folks to, well, once we do the DM, even if you went with all the images, you know, enabled, this is a point where you go into the next module, which is ortho. You definitely want to disable all your obliques. This is a part of the process where even the software will tell you, this image is too oblique, we're going to skip it entirely for the orthorectification process. I truly recommend to go and disable those and moving down into the orthorectification step. And now we're only going to orthorectify our nadir images. With the product we need and for the outputs we need, those are the images that are necessary. So that's basically the suggestion that we would make, right?
Yeah, every input image takes X amount of time to process. So if it's not bringing value, take it out of the process.
Absolutely right. Mm-hmm. Yes. One last comment I'll make here is the compression. This is probably on my top list of, you know, most asked questions by our users is, I'm getting a huge folder, 100 gig folder of ortho. So I always advise them to compress. And most folks say, hey, but is it really going to look bad? Like if I compress, I always challenge them to compare the compressed output versus the non-compressed. But I told them, do a blind comparison, right? So you don't know which one you're looking at. And then really see if there's a big difference. And some folks come back and say, no, there's not. You know, I can go with a compression at the ortho level, and I couldn't even tell the difference of the orthos.
Yep.
And the other side of it is folks who say, no, in the requirements of the project, there's no compression allowed. That's okay. We'll have to live with a large amount of data. But, you know, this is the secret. Just add your compression JPEG and TIFF, and you will definitely create something that is much more smaller. So we'll process the orthos, of course. For all you folks who are probably familiar with the ortho folder, and even always gives you the warning of saying, like, do you want to continue? It's going to take some good amount of time.
Yeah.
this project is fine enough, so we'll load up our orthos. And I had today actually a call, Eric. This gentleman was dealing with, you know, doing a little bit of editing on seam lines. And he was like, you know, something I've noticed with a lot of softwares is when you do seamline edits, they adjust the image, not the ortho. I was getting a lot of discrepancies there. And he said, does your software take into account the orthos when you're doing seamline edits? And I was like, absolutely. He almost said, I'll buy right now. Let's do this. And he was like, so yeah. Many problems with this. It's a huge benefit. And especially for color corrections and water bodies, being able to disable those orthos, and you would do the same way as I did with the images. It definitely adds a huge benefit. So just wanted to throw that out there. It's one of the things that we all almost never turn on the orthos, but in this case, for this gentleman, they were extremely sure. valuable. The last step in the process, mosaic creation. We'll go through a standard mosaic creation. Really not much I would change here. And the last part of it is going to what we're talking about, 3D model generation. Are we going to do it only with the Nadir? No. Here is where they become handy, and we're going to enable all our obliques. So let's turn these guys back on and go into the 3D model generation. Of course, we're going to do it create from a mesh. So we're going to use the DSM. We're using that input, and then we can basically adjust our model size. And as we were talking about earlier, man, those are a ton amount of triangles. Yeah. I can't even count that number. So it's pretty impressive. I will never go to maximal. So again, it's something that pretty beefy machine, you want to try that out. Yeah. But I would always recommend to stay on the safe side. But these are my recommendations for doing this type of work. And yeah, I guess we can certainly turn on couple of outputs here as far as the 3D model goes.
Mm-hmm. So while you're doing that, I just wanted to bring up, if we were just to create an ortho mosaic and we had our DSM, then what you would see in that mosaic along the sides of the structure with the DSM, you just basically see a smear from the top to the bottom, just pulling that pixel value down. So when we go into modeling mode, it is now starting to texturize the sides of those structures. So here's a good example. You can see, you know, the sides of the hangers, you know, the doors, things like that. So that's really the difference between the two.
That's right. And you know, that those are the beauty shots. So yeah. That's what realtors want. They want the facades and, you know, not top-down views. Be talking about that specific output. In this case, it looks beautiful, right? We have those elements and they're not cakey and they're not terrible like in my products back in the day. So these look really good in comparison to what I used to give to superintendents. So
well, and in general in this product it's for the most part a flat surface with a few structures on it, very few stories. So the 3D model that is generated can look really, really nice. When you start to get into an urban canyon, or you start to get into areas where, you know, next to the structure is trees and things like that, then you're really going to have to start to do some editing to yeah. wipe away yeah. some of the things that a 3D mesh will absorb and put into your scene. You may not need it if you're looking for the sides of buildings and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think we have a last product here. I assume, you know, we can turn on the Point Cloud for yeah. you folks who love the 3D. So let's give this guy a run. It's loading. Good question, Eric. Can you bring in your iPhone pictures into this and just put it in the collection of images and hope the software will use them?
You know what? I haven't tried it. I don't think so, but maybe you can. You tell me.
Yeah, I tried it. It didn't work. Yeah. So I remember when I was first playing with softwares and I was like, you know what? Oh man, how can I improve my 3D models? And I basically started using pictures and tried to put it in the same image collection. Of course, not the same size, not the same focal length, but it never worked. So I was really, really sad. But at the same time, I learned that their products, they're dedicated of using those type of imageries from your phone, right? You yeah. want to do, phones come now with your LiDAR sensor and you can scan things with your phone and do that type of reality capture with your phone. And that's a very specific product. You mentioned Matterport too. That's one I had on the list. It's a great product and it's intended to do specifically that. This is aerial, goes directly into aerial, the way it captures, you know, there's a very scientific way of doing it. There's science behind it. So mixing and matching products and images not always gives you the best results. So Anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, but again, what I think what you're getting at is that you also have, or you can also produce a point cloud that has RGB values. That point cloud is going to pick up a lot of things that would be the sides of facades and so forth. Just,
Correct.
it's that it's a point cloud and not a mesh. I mean, these help in your they can help in your mesh as well. So, but again, the texturization and all that is, it comes from having the addition of those oblique images in there when and if you need them. I guess to summarize, if you're just doing strictly mapping deliverables, you don't need the obliques. However, if you're extending what your deliverables are to include such things as 3D structures, facades, and so forth, then obliques do become a help. And based on the angles that you set those obliques at when you capture the data, it will drive kind of the challenges you're going to have in processing. Would that be correct?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And of course, take into account, no taking pictures of the sun and don't take pictures of your buddy right next to you. So yeah,
That's right.
slight oblique, that's the key.
That's right. So, with that, again, I think you've answered all the questions for me, but you brought up earlier that we now have another way for our users to access us. Give everybody some information on that.
Sure, absolutely. And folks probably have seen this in our email correspondence. We have a link to our community forum. It's some active community forum, and we have a ton of topics there to talk about photogrammetry. We had some early adopters who really gave us a lot of information on things they had questions on or wasn't entirely clear on, tips and tricks that we use sometimes on a production level. So I really invite you folks to join the community, ask away. We have, like I said, a ton of material already in there. But if you guys have a specific question as related to the software or even data collection, feel free to jump in, ask away.
Always appreciated, David. Once again, thanks. Thank you, the listener, for joining us. If you enjoyed this podcast, please share on social media. And again, a reminder that our webinars, our tutorials, our interviews, and our podcasts are all available on our website, simactive.com, under the Learning tab. Until next time, thank you.